Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Nearly 120 years after the Dreyfus Affair first gripped Europe, the case still fascinates scholars who have long debated the circumstances that sent French artillery officer Alfred Dreyfus to exile for treason and the event's historical importance. The flimsy case against Dreyfus betrayed the growing anti-Semitism in Europe at the dawn of the 20th century. Accused of leaking state secrets to the Germans during a shaky time in Franco-Prussian relations, Dreyfus found himself in an Orwellian nightmare, ambushed by former colleagues and made a scapegoat, perhaps because he was independently wealthy and Jewish. Thanks to public outcry from leading figures like Emile Zola, eventually Dreyfus was exonerated, more than a decade after his initial arrest and with his name already entrenched as a historical point of debate. Acclaimed novelist and historian Piers Paul Reid has written more than 24 books and now turns his attention to what historians agree is one of the worst miscarriages of justice in modern Western history in the Dreyfus Affair, the scandal that tore France in two, which is published by Bloomsbury. Piers Paul Reid, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Roundtable.
Very nice to be with you.
So many people have covered this topic over the years, over the past 100 years. What brought you to this topic?
Well, it's a wonderful story which hasn't been told in a straight narrative form in English for quite a while. And there have been not perhaps new discoveries, but new developments since then. Also, every time you look at the story, you know, one does so from one's own perspective and one can see it in a slightly different light. I'm a Roman Catholic and the Catholics came out very badly from the Dreyfus Affair, and I was very keen to know why and to know what was the cause of this terrible outburst of anti-Semitism. But, you know, Zeller himself, before he intervened, he recognized that it was an extraordinary story with amazing characters and dramas, and I suppose as a sort of novelist, that was partly what drew me to it.
You're right, it's a natural story. There's a lot of drama and a lot of double-crossing, but I wondered if you could say more about the role of Catholics and what exactly led up to this moment where Dreyfus is accused in terms of some larger geopolitical questions.
It really starts at the French Revolution when the revolutionaries quarreled with the Catholic Church, and that led to a very severe persecution of Catholics, which they never forgot. So by and large, the Catholics in France were very against the idea of democracy, against the republic, and would have liked to see the return of a king. On the other hand, the Jewish community in France, which until the revolution had been living under severe limitations and disabilities, was liberated at the time of the French Revolution. Therefore, the Jewish community had every reason to be in favor of the republic and back the republic. And they also took advantage of first their liberation, but also the tremendous expansion of the money economy in Europe and the Industrial Revolution, which took place in the 19th century. So by the time we get to the Dreyfus Affair, many French Jews were extremely powerful and influential. They most of the banks were Jewish and a lot of the industrial conglomerates. And so the sort of French people, a lot of French people felt they'd been sort of left behind and that this was a kind of elite that was dominating France. And that was one of the sources of the anti-Semitism. On top of that, because of the continuing quarrel between the Republicans and the Catholics, a lot of Catholics had been excluded from the civil service and from the judiciary, and that also made them resentful because some of their places they'd been replaced by Jewish, French Jews or Protestants, and they deeply resented this. The only institution where they still felt they had a place was the French army.
Why, then, was the officer class so attractive to that class of Jewish leaders? Because you make the point that while they were such a small portion of the population, in that elite level of the army, they were legion.
You know, the impression is often given in histories of the Dreyfus Affair that the whole army was sort of institutionally anti-Semitic, and that isn't true. There were 300 officers, Jewish officers in the French army, including two generals. It was really the general staff that was still the preserve of not necessarily Catholic, but sort of non-Jewish officers. And Dreyfus, who was an extremely bright, able, high flyer in the officer corps, was very keen to get into the general staff. And he was excluded because, well, this is where you see historians differ. Some would say it was because he was Jewish, but others would say, well, it was because he was quite an awkward character. He was extremely clever, slightly arrogant, sort of awkward and made no friends. He had made no friends among the officers in the French army, which, of course, when the time came for him to go on trial, worked to his disadvantage.
Is there any doubt today, as you've researched this case, that he was, in fact, completely innocent?
He was completely innocent. Now, I don't think anyone now disputes that. It's a sort of slight embarrassment to the French army still. They were very reluctant to admit that he was innocent right into the 20th century. In fact, the official history of the French army only acknowledged that he, without doubt, he was innocent as late as the 1990s. But the question is, you know, who were the good guys and who were the bad guys? And most history has shown the whole thing in black and white, that the people who worked to exonerate Dreyfus were the good guys, and the people who wanted to keep him or felt he was guilty were the bad guys. And to some extent that's true, but it's not the whole story. The problem was that the army high command, when they realized he was probably innocent, decided to sort of bury the fact, and they forged documents which they showed to ministers, which seemed to point to Dreyfus's guilt. And they kept saying they couldn't make these documents public for reasons of national security. So the French right wing, as it were, thought these people who say Dreyfus is innocent and want to get him released are really just doing that to discredit the army at a very dangerous time in European politics. In other words, they're a kind of internal fifth column, they're anti-patriotic. And that is what whipped up their indignation, particularly because they felt that the Jews in France, some of whom had, almost all of whom came from Alsace, which had a very Germanic culture. I mean, Dreyfus himself spoke with a German accent, couldn't really be trusted to side with France in any future war with Germany. And they were quite wrong about that, because Dreyfus was, in fact, an extremely patriotic Frenchman. But that was their perception.
Right. You note that his family, in fact, given the choice, chose French nationalism over going over to the German side when it had the opportunity in Alsace.
Yes, because Alsace, after the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, Alsace was annexed to Germany, and all the people who lived there, who'd previously been French citizens, had to choose between being German and French. And although Dreyfus's brother was really forced to be German because they had all their factories there, their textile factories, Dreyfus himself chose to be French. And, you know, France was a wonderful country for someone who was Jewish in Europe at the time. It was really the only country where Jews had full rights as citizens. And, you know, the sky was the limit, not just in banking and commerce, but also in the civil service and, as Dreyfus hoped, in the army.
So does this case say more about the domestic French politics of the time or the bad relations between France and Germany? Because it seems that the state secrets that are sort of at question here on these forged documents purported to be written in Dreyfus's hand were ultimately not that important.
Well, that's the irony of the whole thing. When they first discovered, you know, this document which was filched from the German embassy, which was brought in the contents of the waste paper basket of the military attaché to the Secret Service, when they saw this document, they concluded that someone very high up in the French army was selling very important secrets. But of course, what later turned out was that the real traitor, who was this officer called Esterhazy, was really playing the Germans along. He didn't really have access to many secrets, but he was very good at kind of cutting and pasting from military journals and documents that were in the public domain and presenting these to the Germans, to this military attaché, Schwarzkoppen, as if they were, you know, inaccessible secrets. And of course, in the end, Schwarzkoppen grew wise to this, and Esterhazy was sort of dropped as a spy.
What does it say to you that Dreyfus, when he finally gets his pardon and comes back, he's lost a good chunk of his life to this case, stays in the army?
Well, he was sentenced to life imprisonment on Devil's Island, which is most ghastly, inhospitable place off the French coast of Guyana in South America. And he spent 4.5 years in solitary confinement there, awful, sort of getting tropical fevers and insects and you know, going almost mad because he had no one to talk to. The guards weren't allowed to talk to him. So when he came back and was given the second trial, he was really a broken man. I mean, his health, both physical and mental, was in a very bad state. And, you know, he wasn't finally exonerated until 1906. And then, as a point of honour, he wanted to be reinstated in the French army. And he was reinstated in the French army. But, you know, he really didn't have the spirit to continue his career. So after a year, he resigned from the army and only went back during the First World War because he was on the reserve. He was obliged to go back and serve as an artillery officer, which he did. But he was, throughout that time, he really had been sort of broken by his experience. Not just physically, but also mentally, because he'd had such faith in the French Republic and in Republican structures, and to feel that he'd been betrayed and deliberately left to die on Devil's Island by these senior army officers who he'd so tremendously admired, was really a terrible disillusion for him, and he was broken by it.
You mentioned briefly before the dissonance in France in dealing with this historic fact of the Dreyfus case. And I wonder, nowadays, there seems to be kind of a fragile understanding between, on the one hand, recognizing this as a moment of national shame and acknowledging that it was a lost opportunity, and on the other hand, lionizing Dreyfus is also problematic. So how is the modern-day view of this affair within France?
Well, I think they prefer not to talk about it. It left a deep fissure in the French body politic, partly because the left wing, the very anti-Catholic, anti-clerical left wing, took advantage of the fiasco of the Dreyfus affair to persecute the Catholic Church. They closed down all the Catholic schools in France, which really at the time provided almost half the educational provision in France, with a law called the Law of Association. They dissolved all the Catholic religious orders. So they had to leave the monasteries and the convents, and all the nursing sisters had to leave the hospitals, and many of them were forced into exile, which in itself was an act of great injustice. So there still are lingering resentments on both sides. You know, the sign that really the fissure has almost healed is that President Sarkozy, the present president, is in fact of Jewish Hungarian descent. And surveys have showed that, in fact, most Catholics in France actually voted for him, which is not something that would have happened at the time of the Dreyfus affair.
The name of the book is The Dreyfus Affair, The Scandal That Tore France in Two. We've been speaking with the author, Piers Paul Reid. I've appreciated your spending this time with us this morning. Thank you.
I've enjoyed talking to you. Many thanks.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.